evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our weekly conversations include you, and if you'd like to join us anytime during the program, our number is 941-3689. That's the number from Oahu. And if you're on the neighbor islands or listening anyplace else for the live stream, you can get to us at 877-941-3689. Over the last few years, Hawaii has been getting input from federal and other experts to craft its strategy to help the homeless. Perhaps no better help is an expert who has almost single-handedly significantly decreased homelessness in his home state. We have him with us here tonight. Lloyd Pendleton is the director of the Utah Homeless Task Force. That's his retirement job. In 2004, as a lone executive, he led the writing and implementing of Utah's 10-year plan for ending chronic homelessness. In 2006, he retired from his career in the welfare department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and went to work for the state. He was loaned by Utah to the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness for 6 months, from September 2012 to March 2013, when he worked with the Department of Justice on reducing homelessness for those coming out of incarceration. Lloyd Pendleton joins us by phone. And in our studio tonight, Colin Kippen, Hawaii's homelessness coordinator. By profession, he's a lawyer and urban planner. He's worked as a prosecutor, defense attorney, civil attorney, and tribal judge in Washington State. Colin Kippen was the senior counsel to the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs under committee chair Daniel Inouye. And this evening, we'll look at how Utah has approached a functional zero homeless population and how Hawaii might emulate its success. Again, you can be part of the discussion. Our phone lines are open at 941-3689 from Oahu, and from anywhere else, 877-941-3689. Welcome to you both.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. Mr. Pendleton, I want to start with you. Utah has done what Hawaii would so much like to do, and you've done it by doing a simple but important thing. You put homeless people into housing. Are you at all bemused at all the attention for what you seem to see as a relatively straightforward solution?
Well, I am a little surprised. It is quite interesting because it is a pretty simple solution. And to just indicate, or to correct a little bit, we have reduced our chronic homelessness to functional zero, not all homelessness, because the chronic homeless population represents about 10% of the total homeless population.
So let's talk just general numbers. When you started in 2004, what did Utah's homeless population look like?
Well, the total homeless population was around 13,000, we estimated, and the chronic homeless population was around 1,950 people.
So roughly 2,000 people. And now?
And now there's 179.
179 chronic. And what's happened to the general homeless population?
The general homeless population was coming down, and when the recession hit, it increased, and now it's starting to come down. We had a big increase in family homelessness during that time period, and so that's something the state will be working on over the next 5 years in reducing that overall family and single adult homeless population.
So,
the last 10 years, we've reduced the chronic home numbers down by 91%.
Right, and that's the part that people are mostly trained on, because people who have come into homelessness because of hard times and other things can find a way out sometimes, or it seems like that's a temporary situation. But the chronic homeless that seem to be there day in and day out is what you've been specifically focusing on. That 13,000 number, though, you mentioned that it increased and it decreased a little bit, or now, more recent times. Is it still hovering roughly around that same number?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
We're about even to where we were last year. Bumped up just a little bit with this year's count. I think we're getting better at doing our counting. And so that has been interesting how flat that has stayed over the last 10 years.
Why do you think?
Well, there's more issues concerning the concentration of wealth. There's more poverty coming into our situation, lesser middle class families. And so that's just becoming more and more challenging. Rents have increased. Wages have not increased that much. So those at the lower end of the income bracket are being squeezed out of their homes. And so I think there's a lot of things that are causing that. And so, and we've we've been providing service. We didn't take services away from the family homelessness. We just focused on a chronic for the last 10 years because they're very expensive to the community.
And you make the point that some of the same issues that Utah is facing are also the issues that Hawaii is facing in terms of general homelessness and family homelessness. But with chronic, to be really specific about how much that was costing your state per person?
Well, many studies have been done that ranges to $40,000 to $48,000 a year per person in emergency services. That means they go to the emergency rooms for their health care, EMT runs, they end up spend a lot of time in jail. We did a small study on a group, and it's about $20,000 we estimated, and we can house them for about $10,000, $11,000 per person. So there's an economic advantage to it, keeps them out of the jail, out of the emergency rooms. And so we use that as part of our message, and plus it's more humane to put them into housing.
You used sort of some economic leverage there, but again, did you just find yourself scratching your head that nobody had sat down to do some relative comparison of what was being spent for people to who were being kept pretty much as chronic homeless versus those who could be put into a home situation?
Well, I think a lot of analysis had been done over the years, and people had researched that. And there are a lot of states, and most states have housing first, which the housing first model was something that we implemented, where you take a person right off the street and you put him into housing, and then you wrap services around them, case management supports, and they can drink in their house just like you can drink in your home. And they can't sell drugs, they have to pay their rent, and they can't be obnoxious to their neighbors. But so they basically have done that research to say it's less expensive to put into housing, and it's doable when you use this housing first model.
Knowing that research and knowing how long it took you to be able to get everybody together in one room and go through it barrier by barrier and problem by problem, was part of the issue the political will to do this?
Right. So a lot of states are doing it, but what, as I've gone around and spoken across the country, matter of fact, I flew into Missoula, Montana tonight. I'm speaking to county commissioners and mayor tomorrow and service providers about what we've done there. What I've observed is, what was unique about Utah is that we had some key champions, including the governor's office, supported us. And then myself and a few others, we got together and we said, we're going to create a new vision. We're going to come together, we're going to collaborate, and we're going to achieve this. And we started out by doing pilots with the new models, learned from that, and then expanded that. And so I think because we did it statewide and was centrally led by the state and locally developed by the local political leaders and service providers, I think that's why we got to where we are.
Have you seen Hawaii's most recent point in time count?
I have, 4,903.
Right. As you look at our numbers, what do you draw from that relative to the experience that you've had in Utah that you think we should especially be paying attention to right now?
Your numbers are not much different than the numbers in Utah. You have quite a, and I didn't do a percent of your population, but it looks like it's probably higher as a percent of your population than Utah. But here it comes back to the same thing. Coming together and focusing on that particular subject, repurposing your resources, and achieving that goal.
All right, stay with us. I want to bring Colin Kippen into this conversation. I know that you've had many conversations with Lloyd Pendleton in past, and glad we could all have one conversation with everyone tonight. And again, if you'd like to join us, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. But Colin Kippen, when you hear Lloyd Pendleton talk about how he was able to do this in Utah and that our numbers are not that different from Utah's, but that it still boiled down to issues of key conveners, people who had the political will to do this, and someone like Lloyd Pendleton who was willing to put out the sweat equity to make it happen, what do you take from that in terms of going back to Hawaii's community?
I think that, first of all, aloha to you, Beth Ann, and aloha, Lloyd.
Hello.
I happened to be in D.C. on some other business, and as I flew back across the country, Lloyd hosted me for a couple of days a couple of weeks ago, and I got to tour the things that he has done. And so the question is, what do I take away from this experience? And for me, it's really been eye-opening because the data is so clear as to what the solution is. It's literally, it's one of those things that you look at and you say, of course, this is the answer. If you want to end people being homeless, then they need to have a home to live in. So let's figure that one out. Let's get them the services that they need. Let's start to collect. Let's start to create this system of understanding who all the homeless people on the streets are. Let's look at this from a completely different perspective. Let's think in terms of ending and not just managing homelessness. And when I talk to Lloyd and when I'm in his presence, it's absolutely clear to me that that was their focus. They were looking for a solution to end homelessness, not simply just to manage it, not simply to be able to say, you know, we've got this much money, let's just see how far that'll take us. They were thinking, we need to end it. And I think it doesn't sound earth-shaking, but it is earth-shaking. Because if you don't believe and if you don't plan to end something, then the systems that you create are never going to get you to that solution.
All that said, and the fact that you draw a very clear distinction between managing the situation and looking to end homelessness, how do you change the mindset of so many people, including lawmakers in the Ledge, who this year put out what some would consider to be a pittance of $1.5 million for Housing First? How do you change their minds and get them to understand that difference?
Well, you know, I think part of it is that when I look at key decision makers have other people who they respect and listen to. And it actually, I think, is sort of like playing billiards, because you need to be thinking of three or four banks that you need to touch before you actually get to move that ball into the pocket. And I think when I consider what was accomplished in Utah, from my perspective, it really is a matter of expanding the conversation to the community, to the faith-based organizations, to those folks who really can start to influence decision makers. Because not always is that an easy thing. Decision makers, especially in the legislature, they have so many other issues that are vying for their time. But I know this about homelessness. During the last election cycle, I was talking to some of the pollsters, and that they said that homelessness was a constant issue on the radar of voters as they were preparing to go to the polls, that this was something that was constantly being reflected in the various polls that were being done. So I think it is an issue that's important. I believe that what we need to be able to do is to have a strategy to really engage our elected officials in a way we haven't done yet.
Lloyd Pendleton, when you've just been listening to Colin Kippen talk about trying to get people to buy into the idea of creating a solution to homelessness and not just managing it, what would you tell him and the rest of us needs to happen right now, tomorrow?
Well, the approach we took was we became aware of the new models. Housing First was the main one. And we learned about it in June of 2005. We met Sam Samberis, who had created this model. We had him in May, and we had him come to Utah in June to talk to us. Then we said, that may work in New York City, but will it work in Salt Lake City? So we set aside $150,000 of an existing funds and created a pilot for 17 chronically homeless individuals and said, we're going to launch this in 2 months while we build 100 units of permanent supportive housing. And as we moved down the road, you know, I said, look, I was reared on a ranch. We had a wood stove and a coal stove, and I chopped the wood for the stove most of the time. I learned to chop the big end of the log first. I said, if we're going to do a pilot, we want to take the most challenging, difficult, chronically homeless persons we can find, and we'll put them into housing in a scattered site. Because if we can house those, then we can house anybody. Because we needed to find out if this new model would work in Salt Lake City. So we did that, and we found that 22 months later, all 17 were still housed. The national average is 85% to be housed after 12 months. And so it proved to us this model that worked in New York City would work in Salt Lake. So it changed our understanding and our belief, and we had knowledge now. And so I have found that pilots become very key in changing the dynamics of the discussion. It's a low cost, low risk, and you bring the key people together, and then you say, we're going to try this and see how it works. And then we became believers in the Housing First model and then went forward and built several hundred units and several hundred scattered sites we have online. So if I were going to move to Hawaii and become part of this process, I would start with pilots and have something going in 3 or 4 or 5 months.
You're talking about a fairly quick lead time.
Yep.
Colin Kippen, we're not known for our fairly quick lead times. How do you take what Lloyd Pendleton just said? I mean, they found out about it in 1 month. The next month, they're talking about doing a pilot program. They've got one up and running within a couple of months. A year later, they're building units for a lot more people than the 17 they piloted. Is there a way we can emulate that?
Actually, the state has a Housing First program that we've implemented. We're intending to, presently we've housed 57 people who are chronically homeless, and we're using a common assessment tool for all of our homeless now, and we've got approximately 4,900 homeless people in Honolulu. We have now used a common way of assessing people for 2,900 of them. So we only have 2,000 more people that we need to be able to assess. But the idea is that if we know them, that we can then figure out what their needs are and that we can then start to triage them into housing. But you're right. Programs like this are difficult because they challenge the standard model. And the standard model really is that, you know, we're going to treat you, we're going to expect that you're going to make all of the improvements we need to have in your life as a homeless individual. And then if you are worthy, if you are successful in all of the things we require of you, we will then house you. But the reality is for some folks and for many of those who are chronically homeless and have mental health or physical health, or they may even have substance abuse issues, you're not going to be able to do that. They're not going to be successful in that standard way of thinking about this. So that's why this is so new. And many of our service providers, you know, have basically said, we're ready for this change. We're looking at the data. And what we see in our data is that every year the homeless number keeps increasing and we're not getting traction. So what we have to do is not only do we have to take a real hard look at Housing First, which we're now doing, but we also need to create a system. And Lloyd hasn't said anything about it, but I want to open this. When I was with Lloyd, what I got to understand very clearly is that it is one group of people. They're all working together. Service providers, government, shelters, emergency shelters, transitional shelters, feeding programs, clinics, everybody is working together in a way that is really unprecedented.
And that we haven't seen it in Hawaii, where in some cases people still hang on to their little fiefdoms.
We're working. We're working hard to make that happen. But I can tell you that my sense was it was like, you know, we have a net here. And the eyes in that net are pretty big in some cases. People fall through the net. When I was in talking with Lloyd and seeing the success he has, I got the impression that his net would carry water.
Pretty potent
and
stuff.
And I like to add to that, and as I've gone around the country and spoken and become more familiar with other areas, we are a very collaborative state. We've come together to make this happen. So not only do we have the champions and we use pilots, it's very important that you come together and let go of your fiefdom, as you call it, and move towards a common vision. That's a key piece of why we did what we've done.
And that kind of model, which, you know, we talk to each other in Hawaii, we think we are so full of aloha that we work so well together, we try, at least that's a myth that we perpetuate, but to hear that you actually did it through getting people to sit down in one room, talk to each other, and then break down barrier after barrier after barrier until you were able to do it. It's inspiring. We're going to take some phone calls now. We've got Dave, who's been waiting patiently on the line, calling us from Kailua. Aloha, Dave, and thank you for your patience.
Hi. You know, I love what Mr. Kippen is doing. He's worked tirelessly on this. And you know what? I love his saying, all hands on deck, and that's exactly what we're going to have. And the Housing First program is a wonderful program, and it needs to really, you know, I think you almost need it to become a Marshall Plan here in the islands, you know. And but part of this all hands on deck is we need every possible kind of housing too. Tiny housing is going up in a number of places across the country.
Dave, can I ask you a question?
Really affordable solution.
Dave, hang on a second. Dave, can I ask you a question? Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Are you homeless?
Well, I'm semi-homeless now. I mean, actually, for my wife and I, and even my son, who has autism, has been homeless for about 8 years, from a van, and then from our car, and then finally in the parks, and then I went to a homeless shelter myself for a couple of years, and I found out that wasn't a great place to be.
But have you been able to be involved with any program that would put you into a Housing First situation?
I'm signed up for that program. Mr. Kibben helped me with that, but I'm on a long list. I'm somewhere around 800 on the list. And the thing is, I know the problem with this Housing First is you got too many. I mean, you got a lot of landlords don't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole. So what you have is, but there is tiny housing villages that could be going on all around these islands, and that's a very affordable solution. And there's many models across the country.
And Dave, we've talked about some of those models in past, and I want to get Colin Kippen to talk about this a little bit. Thanks very much for your call. We wish you and your family all the best.
Oh, thank you.
When we talk about building units in Utah, where you've got a lot of land, and there are possibilities for Utah that may not exist in Hawaii, is that something that is also a myth that we tell ourselves as, you know, communities say, well, maybe I don't want that in my community. Sure, it might be nice to end homelessness, but I'm not sure I want to have this tiny house community living right next to my house.
Well, I think this issue about not in my backyard. You know, we want to solve the problem, but we want to solve it in someone else's neighborhood, and that's always, you know, that's sort of the worst of who we are, I think, as a people, and especially here in Hawaii. But I think you ought to ask Lloyd about this housing building issue, because I know that they're also facing a very tough market in terms of their ability to build where they are.
So, Lloyd, I mean, do we make an assumption here that because Utah is a much bigger state and has more available land that it was maybe easier for you to do? Or as Colin Kippen is suggesting, you had some real issues with building those units?
We had some issues. It may not be as challenging as in Hawaii because you're a little more densely populated. But we worked very diligently. When we were going to put a unit into place, we went around and talked to the businesses and talked to the neighbors and invited them to come in and be part of the planning process to take a look at the security issues and what they would want. And so we were able to build several hundred units with very little outward NIMBYism. We did have one place where they protested and made a big issue, so we had to wait a few more months, did a study, hired a professor to come in and take a look at it. And so we then worked that through, and one of the issues was there's elementary kids that were going to be walking past that housing project. So they awfulized and thought things would happen to them. Well, when we got it built, and it's been up and operating for about 4 years now, it has become a very key part of the neighborhood. The church groups come over and do service projects and provide meals. The children walk by and they talk to the residents who have been formerly homeless. And so it's become a very positive part of the neighborhood. And we go and let the churches know this is a great service opportunity. When these individuals come in, they have needs, and so the churches do quilts and move-in kits and food baskets and everything else. So we've turned it in to a great service opportunity, and so we really haven't had the NIMBYism that maybe other places have.
So
we've worked diligently to address that and not surprise people.
But to go from what you called as awfulizing it to welcoming it and seeing it as a great success took some work. Colin Kippen, what do we do to be able to get on that path? Because we see a lot of NIMBYism and we hear a lot of people awfulizing, to use Lloyd Pendleton's word, about it. How do we move in that direction? I mean, they seem to have done study after study and done a good job of moving through that. Not so much in Hawaii.
Well, one of the things I think that there's a myth about is that homeless people are not from communities. And many of the homeless that I see are people who are from communities that they're homeless in. And I think every community has a responsibility to take care of the less fortunate in their own community. And I think that again, this is my personal opinion and my bias. To me, that is what makes Hawaii the special place that it is. And I think if we start to segregate ourselves, I think we would have lost something which is really a key part of the fabric of what it means to be living in Hawaii. This idea of aloha and of being, you know, living with other people who are not the same as you and accepting them for who they are, that is absolutely what I think is the essence of what it means, of what aloha means to me.
But is that reality, or is that, as I was sort of intimating before to you, a myth we tell ourselves because we don't welcome this? We don't look at this as a situation that we can absolutely solve if we wanted to.
Well, I think the other part of this, and, you know, I think that this element of hope, fueled by, you know, the pragmatism of looking at things that work, is really something that I think that Lloyd Pendleton and Utah have figured out how to do. Because he took these ideas, which I think would, and Lloyd, you probably need to comment on it, might have seemed a bit alien for, you know, a conservative state such as Utah, to really come to that place where you said, you know, it makes the most sense for us to house these people first. So again, the way I look at this is, you know, a great idea, you know, some discipline in terms of how we look at these things, how we collect this data, putting this data, you know, having this data become, and these ideas become part of our conversation, and then really branching out into our communities in a way where we expect people to confront their prejudices and their ignorance around this subject.
Well, let me add a couple of points then. I mean, when I heard about the 10-year planning process, and I read a couple of 10-year plans back in 2003, I said, those guys in D.C. are smoking something. I thought it was a silly idea. Then in 2003, I went to a four-day conference in which they brought in people and reported on the research and what the chronic homeless population is and how they're defined and their needs and the housing first model. And I can remember flying out of Chicago that after that training, I said, if there's any state in the union that can accomplish this goal, the state of Utah can. I personally became convinced because when I was on the ranch, I'd see homeless people when I'd drive into Salt Lake City, and I'd say, you lazy bums, get a job and pick yourself up by the bootstraps. Well, I've now come to realize that they don't have any boots, so they can't pull themselves up. So I've gone through the metamorphosis also, but I could see it could be done. We just need to get them into housing. We could come together. And so for me, if we have a person in the community that's hurting, we're all hurting. And I call them citizens. They're not homeless people. They're not them. They're homeless citizens. They're part of us. And so we look at it that way, that they're just, some have lost their job, medical issues, and most of them are temporarily homeless. We have 80% that are in the shelter less than 30 days. They're in and they're out. They just need some support. We have 10% that are episodically homeless and 10% that are chronic. And a high percent in the 90s have been abused as children sexually, physically, emotionally, mentally, and learning disabilities. And so they need extra intervention, but they're still part of our community. So that's the belief we have, and we feel very compassionate about our homeless citizens, as well as being collaborative and having champions. And so I see all these things have come together. And most faiths, whether you're Muslim, Jewish, Christian, believe about taking care of those in need. And so we have a strong faith-based group, organizations in Utah, so they came to the table as well. So it's a community effort, and we care for one another. And yes, we're a conservative state, but that doesn't mean we don't care about people. At the same time, there's accountability. If they get this housing, it's not free, they pay rent, and or $50, whichever, they pay 30% of their income, or $50, whichever is greater. And they can be evicted for not paying rent. We give them a scholarship for the first two or three months until they get some income, get on their disability insurance. So there is a strong commitment to the hope and the results, and it can be achieved. So I think that's been a big piece of why we've been able to accomplish what we've accomplished.
Lloyd Pendleton, Colin Kippen, we have callers on the line. If you'd like to join us, 941-3689 is our number, 941-3689, or 877-941-3689. In studio is Colin Kippen. You know he's Hawaii's homelessness coordinator. On the phone with us is Lloyd Pendleton, the director of the Utah Homeless Task Force, and they've done a remarkable job with being able to bring their chronic homeless to functional zero, their population of chronic homelessness. We're talking about lessons that Hawaii might take away from that. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And we're going to someone who obviously dialed that last number, Alex, calling us from Concord, California. Aloha. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
A pleasure.
Wonderful. Well, I guess my question to Lloyd, and I guess everyone's questions that as he goes around the country, is what is the secret sauce? If he could summarize maybe in a couple of sentences what the vision statement is in Utah for, you know, with the agencies, whether that's healthcare, housing, social work.
Hang on, Alex. Make sure you talk into your handset because we're losing you.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
You.
Can you hear me?
Or into your phone if you're on a phone.
No problem. Can you hear me better now?
Much better.
Sorry about
so
that.
Much better.
Yeah. I was just asking what the secret sauce was.
Yeah, we heard that part, and then you sort of trailed away.
And then the second thing was if you could summarize maybe the mission statement on vision statement of, you know, the different agencies that have collaborated, the different faiths, maybe in a sentence or two, kind of what would that be?
All right, let's get back in on the conversation. Okay, so looking at some sort of secret sauce, what is it?
The secret sauce is champions. You can put a lot of money into a project, but if you don't have a champion or champions that are committed to that, it's not going to achieve its objective. And so when I go out and went across the state, I was looking for the local champion. And when I found them that had the compassion and willingness to be taught and commit to this, then I would help build the program around them. And so that's really the secret sauce, is the champions. And then you build that champion base. Then our vision statement is, and it's in every presentation I make, and it's a common, it was approved by our state homeless coordinating committee, and it is, everyone has access to safe, decent, affordable housing with the needed supports and resources for self-sufficiency and well-being. So as a community, we're committing to give all of our homeless people, and we started with the chronic, and then the veterans have been added in, to give them a housing opportunity. And by 2020, we'll have the families and the homeless youth a housing opportunity. And we as a community can go and invite Pete, who's been on the street 20 years, to come into housing, but he doesn't want to. Mental health issues, his buddies are out on the street, he's housing resistant. We honor that. We will continue to outreach to him until he's finally willing to come in. But as a community, we can do that. It's unrealistic to say we will have everybody housed by December 31st, 2015, because a lot will choose not to come in. So we have a very realistic vision statement, and we are committed to that.
Colin Kippen, you've just heard the secret sauce from Lloyd Pendleton in Utah. Do we have enough champions to make that secret sauce?
I have to believe we do. It's a matter of finding them. And, you know, when he talks about his mission statement, I think it gets to this idea of functional zero. So they've reached functional zero, which means that there may be people who don't want to come into housing, but they have the capacity, if those individuals are willing, to take care of them and to house them. So that's functional zero, because the circumstances that cause a person to be homeless are always at work. So we don't know what that'll be for any given individual. But functional zero is when we get to that place where we have a system that has the capacity not just to manage, but to end homelessness.
I guess you're getting a little emotional about this. You live with this, I'm sure. But you have to, in a way. I mean, looking at what Lloyd Pendleton has done to be able to be a convener, you've got to be able to do that day in and day out and have the longevity of the plan and of the vision. Is that something that we have in Hawaii? That, I mean, you're in your position as long as you're in your position. But how do you take that and make sure that moves forward for the next 5 years, the next 10 years?
Well, you have to branch out. You really have to branch out. You have to get outside your personal comfort zone. But really, when I talked about the carom shot, the billiard carom shot, where one ball hits another ball, which hits another ball, which then goes into the pocket, the idea really is that you've got to really spread this message. And you've really got to be able to affect the people who will affect the decision makers. And the other part of this conversation, which is one that is just starting to take root, it's like a wave that's building, is the conversation with faith-based communities, with neighborhood boards, and with the business sector. And so here's what I want to say about that. If we're going to get involved in this, we cannot be segmented. We cannot be divided. We cannot be in that place where it's every agency, every man for him or herself. We've all got to be in this together. And when I talked about what's going on in Salt Lake City and in Utah, when I talked about that net with the eyes that are so tight that you can carry water, that's what we need to be. It cannot be survival of the fittest. It cannot be, you know, one agency versus another. It's got to be a unified, collective, collaborative effort.
They did it with already existing money, just reapportioning. And you heard Lloyd Pendleton say that they have to, you know, reapportion already existing resources. Can we do that too?
We can do that. That's not something I have the power to do. I don't manage any programs other than the Hawaii Interagency Council on Homelessness, and I have no budget. But you know, I do have contacts, and I do have people that I know are thoughtful and that can help in this. So my intention is to recruit people, as many as I can. And I'm really hoping, Lloyd, that Hawaii's on your agenda at some point in the future.
It's on my agenda, and we're working on some ideas. And just to add to that, Beth-Ann, I had no money. I had no budget, and I had nobody that reported to me, but I developed the influence of those that had the funds, and so it can be done. But every day I woke up for the last 9 years, and for the three previous years, I woke up and spent half my day or quarter day working at it because I was on loan from the LDS Church. But the last 9 years, I have awakened each morning, sorry, how do we achieve this goal? How do we get this message out deeper and broader? And who else needs to be brought in? And a political leader doesn't run, so in the next year you have to educate a new person. So it's that consistent message. And so it can be done, and you do need to find those that do have the funds and can influence them. Because when we started out, I went out and said, we're going to end chronic homelessness. And they said, well, give us more money. I said, no, you'll continue to do the same things you've been doing, and that hasn't been working. And I'm not willing to go to the legislature, the funders, donors and philanthropic folks and ask for money to implement a new program until we can say to them the money we have now has been repurposed and is getting the desired results. So we went through 2 or 3 years of some weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth among service providers when we repurposed funds away from those that were doing good programs but were not now focused on their new vision. And we had some low-performing service providers that were not really willing to come up to appropriate performance, so we took the funds away from them and put them into agencies that had good performance. So after 2 or 3 years, then we could go and say, we do need more resources, And when you deliver and invest $1 million, here's what we can deliver for you. So it became a different discussion after the first two or three years, because we had repurposed our funds to the new vision statement.
You repurposed your funds to the new vision statement. The providers who got hip to that pretty much self-selected to be part of your plan, and
right.
those who didn't went unfunded because they weren't performing.
Right.
Okay.
So there's accountability that needs to be there. You need to be using the new model. You need to be looking at your outcomes and your results. And so that was brought into the system. You use data to take a look at it. So, yes, you're disciplining the system. You're improving the effectiveness of the system and as well as the efficiency.
All right. We've got other callers on the line who want to talk to both of you. Going now to Tim calling us from Wailuku. And just a note, if you'd like to be next, better call soon, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Aloha, Tim. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. Good evening. Well, you know, listening, I'm really happy that, you know, people are trying to come up with an idea to help the homeless people here and give them housing, which is probably a good thing. But I just want to make an observation. You know, I'm over here on Maui, and, you know, it's we are aloha and take care of the people of our community. But what I've noticed is that out of all the homeless people that I've had, you know, talked to and said, hi, how you doing? You know, where are you from? One person. I've only met one person that was homeless. It was from Hawaii. They were in Hawaii, working in Hawaii. Got on the bad times. They were homeless. Everybody else is from someplace else on the mainland. They're not from here.
All right.
And on Maui, I've noticed that in the last, like, maybe 6 months or a year, there's like 30 or 40 more people mm-hmm. just in the Kahului area that didn't live here. And they have, you know, they have mental issues. They, you know, they're talking to themselves. They're causing problems and things like that. Well, this is an island. How did they get here? Somebody had to put them on a plane, had to give them medication, and bring them here.
Or perhaps they were here.
And that's I think if people are bringing their homeless here, why can't we do the same thing and help them and say, hey, we'll give you a ticket, and you know, and then that will
well, there
free
there
up
was
more
a plan that was floated
that
last
really
session.
Need it.
Hang on, there was a program that was floated like that, a bill that was floated last session, and we had, you know, some discussion about that. But Colin Kippen, you have some numbers about how many people are actually counted who are from other places versus people who are right there in their community, because he's challenging your idea that the people who are needing our help are people from our own communities.
Well, you know, so the data that we collect on this, and this is a couple of things before I get into the data. The first thing is that a lot of people have resources, so you may choose to come here. So that may be something somebody may not have sent you. You may have visited yourself. But the question really about you're not from here is really an interesting question, because you know, I happen to be Native Hawaiian. Everybody else is from someplace else. So, I mean, I could start making that argument, you know, and I've actually heard people make that argument. But I'm not going to make that argument. But here's what the data says. What the data says is that statewide, 16% of adult clients who have sought services have lived in Hawaii for less than 5 years. So that's 16%. The vast majority of people here who are homeless are from here. But again, the question is, from here, what does that mean? Does that mean you've been here a year, you came over and you had a job and then you lost it, you were here for 5 years and something happened, you lost your job, the economy got sour, you broke up, a relationship ended, you had a major disabling event in your life? So when we start to say, you're not from here, we really need to be careful that that's not code for you're not the same as me.
Or we're not going to help you, or
we're not going to help you, because the reality is that, you know, we're part of a federal system, and everybody has the right to travel from one state to the other. And in fact, that is one of the hallmarks of our constitutional system. So goods and services and ideas flow freely from one place to another, just as people do. But if you just look at the data, the vast majority of people who are homeless have been here for a long time.
Which sort of puts a very different angle to the idea that somehow people were popped on a plane and sent to Hawaii because it's easy to be homeless in Hawaii.
The other thing I think that happens is that when you start to look at some of the areas where people aggregate, you know, some people, I mean, we have a very vibrant tourist economy. We invite people from all over the world, and we actually want to invite those people who can spend the most money to come to Hawaii. But the message goes out to the world, and people with no money or very little money decide that this is paradise and they want to see it as well. So our industry, our marketing of ourselves to the world really is, I think, one of the drivers of why people come here. And when people do come here and find out that, you know, they can't make it here, service providers have always created programs where they want to reunify families and help people get back to where they're from if they're not here.
IHS was doing that.
And IHS is doing that, and they're presently doing it. In fact, other service providers have done that as well. They haven't made a big deal of it because they don't want people coming over here knowing that they're going to get a free ride, get a free ride home.
All right, let's take a few more callers. David calling us from Kauai. Aloha, David. Thanks for your patience. David, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I'm sorry, Daniel, not David. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Daniel.
It's okay. That's fine. So I would just like to suggest that we need to also have maybe a more macro view of this issue as far as our national culture and even statewide. Poor people are essentially dehumanized, and they're just called homeless or vagrants or what have you. And I think everyone listening needs to understand that they themselves and everyone around them are more important and command more respect and are more valuable than their ability to attain capital. Your paycheck doesn't define you as a human being. And we kind of have a culture where if you are poor, you're ashamed. If you're poor, you're less than. And that essentially allows us to dehumanize people, and it doesn't put any, I guess, meaning or thrust behind trying to approach these problems, because there's no care. They're just less than human. And so, you know, many cultures over the world have this idea where, you know, have many stories where, okay, people are poor, but, you know, maybe they're wise or maybe they're very kind or something like that. Here, if you're poor, it's legitimately criminal in many cases. And so we need to relook at how we define humanity and citizenry and the value of people, not based on the ability to acquire capital.
All right, Daniel, I'm going to stop you right there.
We need to have a bit more of a social view.
Hang on a second. You've made your point. And I want to bring Lloyd Pendleton back into this because that was the bedrock of how they were able to form their plan. Lloyd, earlier in the show, you talked about looking at everyone as being a citizen, as being a person, and being able to see intrinsic value in all people, including all of those people who were chronically homeless.
Yes. We don't call them homeless people or homeless. We call them homeless individuals or chronically homeless individuals or chronically homeless citizens or homeless citizens. And so we do not objectify them. And Daniel made a good point. I also want to go back to Tim's point in that 25% of the people that we serve are from outside the state. Utah has had one of the best economies for the last several years. They've always been 2 to 3 percentage points below the national unemployment rate. Right now, we're the leading growth economy for jobs in the country. And our unemployment rate's, I think, 3.4%. So people come to Utah to get jobs because they hear this good news. And so we have a big influx of people who come there. Job doesn't work out, so they end up in the shelter and receiving services. So that argument can be made if you build that they will come, or you have the tourists, or we have one of the better economies. That's the reality. It's going to come. So rather than be upset about it, we just say that's part of who we are, and they're still part. They're a homeless citizen, and so we accept them into that and not try to fight it.
Which I think it ends up answering a question that a lot of people in Hawaii have, because you've got an economy that's come back. You have jobs. People are coming there to be part of that economy.
Right.
And if you're a homeless person and you're able to get a job fairly easily, and then you're in a housing first situation, you're able to pay whatever it may be, the $50 or 30% of your income, that sounds a lot easier than what some people in Hawaii would say is what they face here. So, Colin, that's a very important part of this plan, having a situation where somebody can feel that they can pay something toward a housing first opportunity.
Right, absolutely, because you're trying to promote self-sufficiency, responsibility while you're doing this, but you're not making it the gateway requirement going in. What you're doing is you're saying, you know, you may not be in a position where you're able to do those things now, but we're going to stick with you. We're going to house you. We're going to stabilize your life, and then we're going to move forward.
But how do you move forward, I guess, is really what we've had a couple of callers ask about. How do you move forward once you get them into a stable position to keep them there? Because it's no fair if you get them in there for a couple of months and then they can't maintain it and they're back out on the street again.
Right. So one of the big changes in our system that we've adopted, and I think Lloyd can probably comment on this too, is that we're triaging the people. I mean, we have a common assessment tool that we're using, and we use that to be able to understand, you know, who are the most chronic, who have the greatest needs, and we put those, we will offer those people housing, but while we offer them housing, we also offer them services, because if you don't have the services, your housing is not going to work. And, of course, if you don't have the housing for this group of people, the services aren't going to work.
So if you don't have the jobs, how do they keep paying for everything?
And obviously jobs are another part of this, because for those, you know, we're always thinking in terms of how do we promote this self-sufficiency. And so jobs are, you know, we have to do the best that we can in our economy. We have to be able to give people the job skills. We have to be able to reduce whatever those barriers are that exist. It may be not having a resume. It may be not having specific job skills that are currently in demand. And, you know, the other part of this conversation is that we want to be able to help that person get their hand on that first rung of the ladder. And so it may not be an executive position, but it's a job. And what we then need to do is you need to assure that when they start to work, that we have a program that can help to make up the difference as they progress. But we don't want to create a situation where we dampen any enthusiasm they have for continuing their progression as they move forward. And that's, unfortunately, I think, one difficulty with our market here. And that is, if you look at, say, for example, public housing, the number that you would pay in public housing is a huge difference from what the market would bear. So we need to start to create in our housing policies a set of steps that a person can walk up and not lose their housing, but can pay more to be able to be housed so that they can progress, so that they can take those promotions, so that they can take those additional responsibilities. And in that way, start to change the model of how we look at the housing that we provide.
Because the housing we provide now, the public housing, people get in it and they're there forever.
Right, because again, the difference between what they're paying and what the market is charging is so great. And what we need to do is we need to figure out a methodology to allow those subsidies to reduce in time, but also to incentivize somebody working and earning more money. Because, again, you know, if that's a family unit, you are, you know, I mean, I'm a parent, my kids are all grown, but one of the lessons that I learned, you know, very late in life as my children got older and older is that, you know, what I said had very little to do with how they turned out. What I did in my daily life was an absolute example for them. So what we want to do is we want to create this example. And that is a matter of public policy. We can affect that by what we do.
Do we have the money to be able to do that? Lloyd, I'm sorry, did I cut you off? I hear you back there.
I was just going to say, as you go through this process, sometimes you try to do it all at once. So to me, you take the 57 that you've got housed now, you expand it to 157, and we call it housing first, employment second. So we have an employment opportunity, and we learned a lot when we did our pilot. So we have that going as well. You also have to keep in mind that when you don't house these chronically homeless people, they're costing you a lot in your emergency rooms, EMT runs, in the jail. You're paying for them anyway.
That's the bottom line. We're paying for it anyway, whether we know it or not.
Correct.
So do we have that money, and do we have the political will, Colin Kippen, from all the rounds that you've been making, to be able to create that stepped situation so someone is incentivized to work and to be part of the community in that way and not simply just be a forever recipient?
I think that the political will is building. I think that the political will is not where it needs to be for us to really make the changes that we're talking about here. And I think it really gets back to the fundamental question about whether or not we're just going to manage what we're presently doing or whether we're going to really make a systemic paradigm shift. And that shift has begun. You know, the work that we're doing with this Housing First project, the accountability systems that we're putting in place, the new data systems that we are creating are really designed to guarantee that if you, as a business or even as a government, put money into this program, that we're going to be able to demonstrate to you that it works. Because if it's a bad system and you pour more money into it, you've just created a monster. It's not going to get you where you want to go, and it's going to really just not be effective.
Lloyd Pendleton, you've been at this now for 11 years. Hawaii's been at it for a couple of years. In some ways, maybe it's a little unfair to compare the two, but once once Utah was very much where Hawaii is right now.
Yes.
For us to be able to make that leap and to bring our chronic homeless population to functional zero, what is it that you see we have to start to do tomorrow? I mean, everything that we've heard Colin Kippen say, notwithstanding, what do you think we have to do if you were to lay out a plan for us?
Well, if I were in Colin's shoes, I would make a list of 4 or 5 key influential people and go and educate them about this whole process and get them to buy into the new vision and become champions in key areas in the way of funding, political will, et cetera, and have them help carry the message. Because until you have those champions that are willing to repurpose the resources, it's an uphill battle. It's tough as it is even with that, but it's doable. So getting those champions becomes key.
It almost sounds as if you've just been made into a development director, having to find donors and having to find key people to buy into the vision.
Oh, I think he's absolutely right. Well, I'll tell you who my first champion is. It's Lloyd. Lloyd, you could be my champion.
Well, thanks. We're in this together, and that's why I'm leaving state employment June 1, and because of the publicity we've gotten, I've had an opportunity to go around and share because I know it can be done. We've done it. And so helping find the champions across the country, because the model works, the economics works, and so it's doable. It's just now getting that group to come together and focus.
But getting the group to come together and focus in Hawaii, in Honolulu, looks very different because you have the city operating in a certain way and you have the state operating a certain way. Don't you also have to make a real bridge and bring the city into this vision too?
Sure. Yep. You want to have one system. You don't want to have, you know, every funder with their own system and with their own set of requirements. And so that, you know, we're basically creating all these systems that collide.
All right.
See, one of the things you have that's a big plus is you have somebody, you have Colin at the state focusing on this. You go around the country, you have governor's office that are not even in the discussion at all.
All right, so
you
we should feel glad at least that we are where
yeah.
we are. Well, I'm very happy to have been able to talk to you tonight. Lloyd Pendleton, director of the Utah Homeless Task Force, thank you so much for making time and being with us this evening.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And Colin Kippen, as always, thanks for being here. We'll see where we can go from here, and maybe we'll be talking about the success Hawaii will have in not too many years from now.
I want to say to you, Beth Ann, as well as to you, Lloyd, ahui ho, which means until we meet again.
Thanks so much. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you tomorrow for The Conversation. Aloha.